The Tom Woods Show, episode 1229.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, this episode is brought to you by Policy Genius. If you've been putting off getting life insurance, there's no reason to put it off any longer. Go to policygenius.com, get quotes, and apply in minutes. It's that easy. Policy Genius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. Kevin Gutzman is my guest today. Kevin and I wrote a book together called Who Killed the Constitution? Kevin is a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University. He holds his PhD from the University of Virginia. He also has a law degree from the University of Texas at Austin. He is the New York Times bestselling author of several books, including The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Constitution, James Madison and the Making of America, and the book most relevant to our discussion today, Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical's Struggle to Remake America. And I'm inviting Kevin right now in particular because we just launched his brand new course called The Thomas Jefferson Nobody Knows over at libertyclassroom.com. So if you haven't joined that yet, now is an outstanding time to do so because what a great course Kevin has created for us. And we're going to focus today on the earlier years of Jefferson's career, because there's a lot of rich material there and really does help us get to know the man and what made the man. Because as you're going to find out, he did some truly extraordinary things that you would not have expected or predicted that somebody from his background would do. So very interesting history awaits us today. Kevin, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Great course you got here on Jefferson. Of course, as I mentioned, you are a biographer of Jefferson. So I want to start off by just asking you the simple question of all people you could have written biographies of. I mean, of course, you've written on James Madison as well. But why Jefferson? What's special about Jefferson in American history in 2 minutes?
Oh, boy. Well, my book is actually, it's not a traditional biography starting with his family background in Wales and so on. Instead, it's a set of essays about his main political and ideological commitments. So there's a chapter on freedom of conscience, there's a chapter on federalism, there's a chapter on colonization, there's a chapter on assimilation, there's a chapter on education, which I think to be the five major themes of his political career. And what's interesting about him to me is that his way of dealing with the major questions of his time was characteristically, in some cases, it can inform our current debates. In some cases, it's completely alien, and yet all of it's interesting. So that's why Jefferson.
The course you've done is more biographical than the book. As you say, your book focuses on areas of significance to which he contributed and had a lot to say. But in this course, you're taking us through really beginning with his birth and his upbringing,
right,
all the way through to the end of his career. So let's try and, I want to trace a little bit of that out. And of course, for the rest, people should, I can't believe there's anybody listening who's not a member of libertyclassroom.com. But if you are one of those stragglers, now's the time to head on over there and join it. So let's start with, let me be honest with you. When I read a biography and it gets to the person's upbringing and education, I skip right over that. I think this is going to bore me to death. I couldn't care less.
Right.
Why, in Jefferson's case, should I care? What is it about that part of his life that helps make him the man he later becomes?
Well, Jefferson's background is actually interesting. Unlike, you know, his dad was a baker and his mom was a homemaker and now he's the world's greatest scientist or whatever. Jefferson came from a long line of people who were important in making America. His family was as if you took the Kennedys and the Bushes and put them together. That's how significant they were in colonial Virginia. Maybe they were more significant than that. In fact, there was one point at which Jefferson's cousin, Edmund Randolph, was governor of Virginia, and lieutenant governor was another Randolph. And Jefferson's mother was a Randolph. So John Marshall's a cousin, John Randolph of Roanoke's a cousin, all kinds of people who were on the colonial council, which was like a combination of cabinet, Senate, and Supreme Court. There were various Randolphs there. And what you get from that is an idea of how embedded Jefferson was in the elite. So it becomes interesting that he decides he's going to try to overthrow not just the colonial relationship to the British monarchy, but all of the main institutional supports of Virginia's hereditary elite. Jefferson then is a kind of, I think the closest analogy to him I can think of in Western history is Philippe Égalité, you know, who is a duke. And when Louis XVI calls for a meeting of the Etats Généraux, there is this duke who says, we need to have more equality. We need to get rid of feudalism. We need, and people are just kind of looking at him. That's essentially the role that Jefferson ends up playing in colonial Virginia, in early Republican Virginia. He's the fellow who goes after the feudal land tenures, which are the chief support of the landed aristocracy in Virginia. You know, Holly Brewer, who's a brilliant historian who's now at the University of Maryland, wrote in a journal article about 20 years ago that when the revolution began, when the Declaration of Independence was promulgated in 1776, about two-thirds of today's state of Virginia was held by about 85 families. So you have these few people who own this enormous estates. It's each of those 85ths of two-thirds of Virginia would be about half of one of today's eight Connecticut counties. So these people were just gigantically wealthy. And the land tenures said that the oldest son inherited everything. That was called primogeniture. And that the current holder, if you had an entailed estate, that is, if a particular legal doctrine had been attached to one of these estates, the current holder could not alienate any of it. So let's say that you were the owner of one of these huge land baronies, and you decided, I don't want my oldest son to inherit everything. I have 12 kids. I love all of them. I'm gonna leave significant mobile property to my daughters, and I'm going to have the four sons divide these fourths equally. You could not do that. You could not either say, okay, when I die, I'm going to have my oldest son inherit everything, but now I'm going to give each of the three younger sons one-tenth of my... No, you couldn't do that either. That was called entail. Your oldest son was entitled to everything. Jefferson was the one who wrote the law in Virginia that got rid of primogeniture and entail. So by the time he died, essentially 50 years after he had written this law abolishing primogeniture and entail, most of these landed estates in Virginia had broken up. Some aristocratically inclined people like John Randolph of Roanoke and other such cousins of Jefferson's so lamented this, and there was a joke that no man with any sons could have written such a law. Well, Jefferson didn't have a son. So, but the point is, this is an often overlooked innovation of Jefferson's that was essential to making Virginia Republican. And it was significant in the sense that it undercut the place of Jefferson's own family, his own class. It's really weird. So again, I think he was like Philippe Égalité saying, you know, the king needs, and I need, to have fewer privileges, fewer rights, less power. I should not have this inherited position. Jefferson struck at not only that prop of his class, but also, of course, famously at slavery, which was one of the main supports besides the land tenures of his class. He laid out a set of assertions about the immorality of slavery that were going to come to be very significant. And he took, and this is something people often overlook nowadays, he took extremely significant steps that weakened slavery. So, for example, the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, says in Article 4 that there cannot be any law passed by Congress to staunch slave imports until 1808. Well, in 1806, in his annual State of the Union message, President Jefferson urged Congress to pass a law letting that power be exercised at the earliest possible constitutional moment. And so in 1807, Congress passed and President Jefferson signed the law that banned slave imports at 12:01 a.m., January 1, 1808. And slave imports essentially stopped. There were a few instances of people smuggling slaves into the country after January 1, 1808, but slave imports essentially stopped. So if there had been a significant additional influx of slaves, it would have been that much more difficult ever to get rid of slavery. And this was mainly Jefferson's doing. It was his idea. He's the one who signed the law. He also was the fellow who wrote the rough draft of the law that banned slavery in the Midwest, today's Midwest. So it could have been that southern Illinois, southern Indiana would have been just more of Kentucky, that is more tobacco land, more of Virginia. But Jefferson didn't want that. And so in Congress, he was the fellow who wrote the first version of the Northwest Ordinance, which ultimately kept slavery out of the Midwest. There are other things he did against slavery, too. He also, and this is a chapter in my book, it's a story I tell in detail in the course, the Liberty Classroom course on Jefferson. He also was the fellow who took the lead in disestablishing the Church of England in Virginia, the Anglican Church, the Episcopal Church, which, of course, had been the colonial church of Virginia. Actually, Virginia's House of Burgesses was the first elected assembly ever in the Western Hemisphere. And in the first year that it met, 1619, it passed a law saying the Church of England was the Church of Virginia. Well, Jefferson didn't want the Church of England to be the Church of Virginia. And he was the fellow who wrote the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, which ultimately passed it after a lot of work by Jefferson and his closest political ally, James Madison. Jefferson also had a solution, what he thought was a solution to the problem, and this is another thing that people overlook nowadays, to what he thought was a serious moral and political philosophical problem of slavery in Virginia and the rest of the United States. And why would that be a problem? Well, because he thought that all men were created equal, not that we're equally tall, short, fat, thin, smart, stupid, athletic, sedentary, but that we all are equally possessed of certain moral integrity that means we're entitled to a role in our own government. And that meant that Black people were entitled to be free, even if they were slaves, they were entitled to be free. And Jefferson, on the other hand, after ruminating on this a lot and writing about it at length, concluded that white Virginians, at least, weren't going to accept this, that it wouldn't be safe to have biracial society in Virginia anyway, because he thought it likely would lead to a race war, which he said could not end but in the extermination of one or the other race. That is a fantasy. But on the other hand, in Jefferson's own lifetime, soon after he wrote these words, there was a revolution in Haiti that did end in the extermination of the white race in Haiti. So Jefferson thought, well, Black people are entitled to be free, but they're slaves here. The whites are prejudiced. The Blacks hate the whites. Jefferson said, speaking for white Virginians, quote, "We give them new reason every day." And so his answer to this problem was what came to be called colonization, finding some other place to which Blacks could be sent. That is, they were entitled to be free, but white Virginians wouldn't let them, so they needed to be found somewhere else where they could be free. And this was not theoretical. This was not rhetorical. Jefferson did work on this in the highest offices in the federal government. He's the only person ever to be Secretary of State, Vice President, and two-term President. And in each of those high offices, he cast about for some place to which Black people in Virginia could be sent, and actually made repeated diplomatic efforts to find such a place. He didn't succeed in doing that in his own career, but his former law student and political acolyte, James Monroe, was president and sponsor of the founding of the West African country of Liberia, some of whose first settlers were slaves from Virginia. So Jefferson thought this would be a receptacle. That was his word, a receptacle for the Black population. It was going to be free in the USA. Finally, Jefferson was born in a society in which, because only a few people owned land, only a few people were educated. There was no public education of any kind in Virginia, except for a college, which, of course, could only be exploited by the wealthy who had some kind of home schooling. Generally, that involved having either a neighborhood school to which wealthy scions could be sent, or some kind of proctor hired to live in one's mansion estate where the whole gaggle of kids could be taught by the same person. Jefferson had a little bit of both, and then he went off to William and Mary, of which he didn't think very much. So he said that there needed to be public education, 3 years worth, so that people would have the rudiments of mathematics besides being given literacy. And this, I think, this program of democratizing is inexplicable. I recently spoke at Monticello, and Andrew O'Shaughnessy, who runs the research effort there, asked me in Q&A afterward, well, how do you account for Jefferson's radicalism? And my answer was, I don't really know. How do you account for Philippe Egalite? How do you account for this? It's just really odd that somebody who's born into this kind of situation should decide, I'm going to wreck every pillar of it. I'm Samson to my class. I'm going to pull the whole temple down on our heads. And yet, that's what he did. And why? Because he was a thoroughgoing Republican, with lowercase d for Democratic, right? He was extremely committed to the idea that every man ought to be involved in his own government, and resentful of foreign whether that was outside the U.S., outside Virginia, outside Albemarle County, foreign dominance. And it's a really interesting story. So the point is, back to your question, which you may have forgotten by now, Jefferson's family background is interesting, and then his education is interesting too. He went to William & Mary, and he accidentally fell in with an Enlightenment figure on the faculty there. There was actually a faculty at William & Mary made up of Anglican priests, except for one guy named William Small, who was an avatar of the Enlightenment, and he took Jefferson under his wing and made him an Enlightened scholar as well. So that, I think, helps to explain, although it doesn't entirely explain, why Jefferson became this radical.
Well, along those lines, you mentioned education. I'm curious now also to talk about not simply educational opportunities, but what he thought the curriculum, the content of the education ought to be, because here, too, he dissented from the conventional view.
Oh, right. He thought that conventional education of Italy and Germany, Britain, France, Spain was going to be worthless to virtually anybody. It could be interesting if you're a nobleman to know Greek, say, or it could be useful if you were going to be a Catholic priest and know Latin. But in general, what good would that do the average Albemarle tobacco farmer? And the answer was, well, not much. So Jefferson thought that the finest minds in Virginia, which could be identified by tracking young boys, or it could be girls, actually. His bill just said children. So he left the question whether it was going to be a monosex system open on purpose. But anyway, he thought that the average person wouldn't be able to use that kind of an education. But what he would be able to use, again, were basic literacy, basic mathematics, a smattering of historical tales about Romans and Britons dealing with aspiring tyrants and deciding what to do about that to defend their own liberty and so on. So besides that, when you got to the peak of it, he thought that the average Joe would get his 3 years, and then after 3 years, there'd be a kind of judgment, evaluation, and then the best in each precinct would be sent on to a regional kind of middle school, really 3 years more, so I guess late elementary school. And after that, the best of those kids would go on to William & Mary, and what people would be taught would be things that would actually be useful to your average farmer. So if you were judged one of the best after the 6 years, then you could go to William & Mary and study what? Well, he thought, if you were going to be a farmer, you could study agronomy, or you could study chemistry, or you could get a little bit of French or Spanish, which might actually be useful. He actually said Spanish likely would always be the second language of America. So this was highly democratized in terms of curriculum. And then when it came to the mode of instruction, instead of having just recitation, which is a highly aristocratic, top-down method of pedagogy, he thought that people should have observation of their laboratory performance. They should have essay examinations in the liberal arts so that people would be assimilating their own learning as they were answering questions instead of just repeating what somebody else thought they ought to know. It was, again, it was a highly visionary, democratic way of structuring an education. And of course, this was not a program Jefferson was successful in having the General Assembly of Virginia adopt in his lifetime, but he did succeed in establishing the University of Virginia with the revolutionary curriculum and the revolutionary method of instruction. And besides that, with the revolutionary form of governance for the university, not just mandates from the state, but government by the professors. So this would be kind of expert managed. There were people among Jefferson's own political group in Virginia who thought, you know, what this is going to lead to is, one of his critics put it, an association of incorporated pedagogues are going to end up running our state government because they'll be in every corner of Virginia and they'll be able to coordinate their political activity. You know, that's pretty clairvoyant. But Jefferson, the optimist, thought, well, the average citizen needs some education. And besides that, Virginia needs to be able to identify its most intelligent and energetic citizens to have them hold the highest offices and so on. So after the Civil War, the men in blue imposed primary and secondary education on Virginia, but UVA was, from the beginning, more or less the kind of radically democratic institution Jefferson wanted it to be.
How is it possible that somebody who held views as radical as you're describing gets elected to the House of Burgesses, 1769? How does that happen? Do people know about his views? Has he fully articulated them at that point?
Well, pre-revolutionary Virginia political culture is very odd in concept because it was highly democratic. About half of adult white men of sound mind could vote, which was just freakishly democratic in an era when, you know, nobody in France could vote, nobody in Spain could vote, nobody in Russia could vote, nobody in Turkey could vote, and so on. You did have places in New England where there was an even more broadly distributed suffrage, but Virginia was very broadly distributed. So in theory, Virginia was a very democratic society. In practice, however, only the few had any education at all. Only the few could afford to go to Williamsburg when the House of Burgesses was in session without receiving any kind of payment for doing that and stay there for weeks. So really, it was predictable that the average farmer would go to the courthouse on election day and vote for Peter Jefferson's son to be their Burgess. They didn't know it. In fact, there was a kind of ethic against making any what we now call campaign promises. And there are famous instances in which people made promises and then lost elections on the ground that they had made promises, right? So people, in other words, were not elected to the House of Burgesses because they had some program or on the basis of what it was thought they would do as Burgesses. In other words, it was democratic in form, but in content, it was a highly deferential kind of political society. So Jefferson went to the House of Burgesses in 1769 without anybody really knowing what he would want to do as a Burgess. And he immediately became notorious for being radical because in the very first session he sat in, he and his cousin, a very established committee chairman Burgess named Richard Bland, proposed a bill that would have meant the eventual end of slavery in Virginia. And Jefferson wrote in his autobiography, which he came to pen in the 18-teens, that he had never heard anything like this. He sat and listened all day long as one after another, the other Burgesses got up and just excoriated Bland. Jefferson was a co-sponsor and Richard Bland was pushing this bill. And Jefferson concluded, he said, that Virginians weren't ready to get rid of slavery. So he was not going to make an issue of getting rid of slavery in politics in Virginia. He was not going to push abolishing it because he just saw no evidence that there was any chance the Burgesses, later the House of Delegates, would go along with that. That's why those measures against slavery I mentioned before, cutting off imports, keeping out of the Midwest, and so on, those are all federal measures.
All right, Kevin, so much more interesting Jefferson stuff I want to get to. I'm not even sure we're going to get to everything I was initially planning to get to. But let me take just a moment for a sponsored message to say that apparently 4 out of 10 people do not have life insurance. This is a bare minimum requirement, folks. You've got to look after your loved ones, and life insurance is actually not that expensive. In fact, life insurance rates are the lowest they've been in 20 years. So the best time to buy is now, and the best place to buy is PolicyGenius.com. PolicyGenius is the easy way to compare life insurance online. In just 5 minutes, you can compare quotes from the top insurers to find the best policy for you. And it's not just life insurance that they make easy. They also compare disability insurance, renter's insurance, and health insurance. PolicyGenius has already helped over 4 million people shop for insurance. If you've been putting off getting life insurance, there's no reason to put it off any longer. Go to PolicyGenius.com, get quotes, and apply in minutes. It's that easy. You could do it right now, and you should, because rates are at their lowest in 20 years. PolicyGenius, the easy way to compare and buy life insurance. I want to talk about notes on the state of Virginia that Jefferson wrote. And I was going to pull my copy off the shelf, and I was running around. The cat caused a problem in my office this morning, and that completely threw me off. I wasn't able to pull my copy off the shelf. But anyway, in there, I mean, there's a lot in there, but one of the things that's in there is Jefferson's somewhat novel understanding of the initial creation and settlement of Virginia and what that would later mean for the way he viewed the role of the king and of Parliament and whether one or the other had any role in governing Virginia. But maybe you could talk about that. But then in general, if you could give maybe just a précis of what is in the notes on the state of Virginia and why Jefferson wrote it.
Well, the reason Jefferson wrote his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, which most scholars consider to be the most important American book of the 18th century, is that a French diplomat, Barbé Marbois, sent questionnaires to significant men in each state, asking them please to describe their states. And so Barbé Marbois said, tell me about your rivers, your streams, your lakes, your mines, your mountains, your ports, major cities, your constitutional history. Tell me about the manners of your people. What about their religion? Can you describe the legal systems? And so for most states, Barbé Marbois received nothing in response. And from a couple, he got kind of lists of two or three sentence answers to his clipped questions. But Jefferson rearranged these so that they proceeded from most general to most particular, and then made it into a 400-page book. And essentially, it's a tour de force of natural history with a lot of geography thrown in. So Jefferson essentially gives you a critique of Virginia society in the context of vaunting Virginia's enormous natural endowments. And along the way, he also gives you quite a bit of his own political philosophy, and he engages in a dispute with the most eminent biologist of the 18th century, another Frenchman, the Comte de Buffon. Buffon had written that all mammals degenerated in the Western Hemisphere, and he and numerous other European biologists by this point took for granted that there was something about the environment of the Western Hemisphere that made mammals degenerate. So he said, there are fewer mammals in the Western Hemisphere. They're smaller than old world mammals. They're less fecund. And as a kind of classic example of this, he pointed to American Indians. He said American Indians, they don't have hair on their faces or their bodies. They're less, the way he put it was, they're less ardent for their female. They, you know, he said they didn't have any significant poetic or musical or architectural accomplishments. Or so Jefferson, in Notes on the State of Virginia, is not only boasting about Virginia in some senses and critiquing it in others, but he is taking Buffon on head on. And nowadays, it's not immediately obvious why he would do that. Some scholars say, well, you know, this is kind of a patriotic book, but it wasn't a patriotic book. It was, in this aspect, Jefferson trying to contribute to the ongoing American attempt to persuade Europeans to move to the Western Hemisphere. But imagine today there are 27 million people in Texas. In 1781, there were fewer than 30,000 people in Texas. So the part of North America that was part of the United States was equally sparsely populated. And American politicians wanted to get people to move from the Netherlands or Germany or Scotland or wherever, France, to the United States. And how would you be able to do that? Well, one thing that you didn't want was for them to think, well, if I move to the Western Hemisphere, my offspring will be less fecund. They won't have any significant intellectual attainment. So clearly he had to answer this, but he thought it was easy to answer. And actually, after several years of this dispute, in which Jefferson ended up being assisted mightily by Benjamin Franklin, Buffon finally admitted, no, he had been mistaken. And Jefferson continued on this path even after he had won the battle. So, for example, when he sent Lewis and Clark to find the Northwest Passage, to find a water route from St. Louis to Washington, to Seattle, essentially, he told them, well, you know, I want you to bring back specimens of every significant animal you find. In fact, ideally, you'd send me a mastodon. So the Indians had told Jefferson that there were still mastodons in the Northwest, and Jefferson wanted to send one to Buffon and say, look at this, it's bigger than your mountain lions in Italy, you know. He actually did, in the end, send a moose from Maine to Buffon, and that, of course, was bigger than European mammals. And besides that, there's a kind of a funny story of a dinner, a state dinner that Franklin, who then was the American minister to France, held outside Paris, where he invited a bunch of French men of letters and some Americans, and they all sat around this table and they got to talking about this degeneracy thesis. And then Franklin smiled and said, okay, how about if we do a little experiment here? If you're an American, stand up. So then he said, if you're a Frenchman, stand up. And famously at the time, Americans were taller than Frenchmen. And actually, the way it worked in North America was that if you started in Massachusetts and kind of walked all the way to South Carolina, you would notice men were getting taller the further south you went. We think this is mainly because of nutrition. But anyway, the Frenchmen all laughed. Everybody agreed this was a good joke, but it wasn't entirely a joke. So anyway, I've lit on this one little aspect of the book, but the book is just full of fascinating little nuggets. And Jefferson's mind was so jam-packed with data and disputes. And if he were alive today, he would be arguing about the role of Google and the future understanding of dark matter and, which mathematical problems needed to be solved first and, what kind of Republican system India ought to have, and just every question that is an open issue in his day is one Jefferson is arguing about. And the thing about him is he will take up a particular topic and then he will become the leading expert in it. So again, this I said it kind of in passing, he beats down the leading biologist in the world on this question of the Western Hemisphere versus the Eastern Hemisphere, and his becomes the reigning understanding. And there are several other areas where he does the same kind of a thing. He's the leading ethnohistorian of the day. In fact, when it comes to archaeology, one aspect of Notes in the State of Virginia is he describes an archaeological excavation he conducted near his father's estate, Shadwell, which is near Monticello. And he describes excavating this Indian burial mound and the methods he used. And I have a colleague at Western Connecticut State University who's an archaeologist of American Indians from New England, and she tells me that Jefferson's description of his 1770s excavation established the techniques that professional archaeologists use until the first decade of the 20th century. So Jefferson was the leading archaeologist in America from the 1780s to the 20th century. He's just a freak.
Yeah, it's not fair on some level.
Right, it's not.
Mr. Egalitarian, and then he's going to run around being the best at everything.
He really was, in several different areas of intellectual life, the leader of his day and for a long time after. So Notes on the State of Virginia has, of course, infamous ruminations I alluded to before on the natural endowments of black people. That's probably the most notorious part of the book today. It also has interesting stuff about freedom of conscience, which, of course, Jefferson was a kind of American pioneer, and very interesting material on Virginia's constitutional system, which, as you said, is ultimately based on his peculiar account of the original settlement of the North American English colonies. And if you were to sit down with Notes on the State of Virginia and just start at page one reading it, after about 15 pages, you'd think, if I have any more details about particular mountains and rivers and so on in Virginia, I think I'm going to go to sleep. But you have to stay with it, because in Jefferson's day, people didn't know this. As I said before, they thought there were mastodons in the Northwest. White people had never been west of, Kentucky, really. They hadn't even settled all of Kentucky yet. So Jefferson's describing this to people who have no idea. And he kind of has no idea, too. So it's just a really interesting book. The first time I read it, I didn't really get it. But now that I understand it, every time I read it, which I do over and over because when I teach Early Republic, I make my students read it. Every time I read it, I find new things in it. It's just amazing.
Well, maybe to Notes in the State of Virginia. I mean, I would be shocked if that was not available online for general reading. So
me too.
I'll link to that. But you know what? I think even though we could obviously continue on, let's let people stew with this a little bit, because this is material that almost nobody knows about Jefferson. And although I think most people also don't know really his political thought all that well. I mean, they know the Declaration, but they don't know they certainly don't know the Kentucky resolutions of 1798 and stuff like that. But I think for now, I want to, because we have talked about that a little bit, I want to say to people, imagine a whole course where everything is like fresh and new about Jefferson, a guy you thought you knew. That's what we've got at libertyclassroom.com. Thanks to Kevin, we now have, I don't know what course this is, 24th. I don't even know how many courses we have now, but it's definitely, definitely worth checking out. Maybe we'll get you back on. We'll try and pull the story up a little bit more toward the end of his career. But the presidency stuff is where everybody immediately wants to go with Jefferson. And I wanted to spend this time instead thinking about just what an interesting and accomplished man he was, and the different fields where he had something to contribute. And I think we've accomplished that here. So, of course, also we want to urge people to read Kevin's book on Jefferson. And so, Kevin, people can get your book, of course, at Amazon and stuff, but it is called
Thomas Jefferson Revolutionary, A Radical's Struggle to Remake America, which you can find at kevingutzman.com.
There you go, kevingutzman.com, G-U-T-Z-M-A-N.com. Definitely check that out. And the thing is, lately I've been doing these long episodes, and now I'm just disciplining myself. Even though I could talk to Kevin Gutzman for hours, on principle, I'm not going to leave them wanting more, leave them saying, doggone it, I need all the Gutzman in the world. And that's what they'll find at libertyclassroom.com. All right, thanks, Kevin.
You're welcome.
All right, folks, even if you don't live in Canada, I want you to listen to what I'm about to say. I got two things to say to folks in Canada. Number one is there's a possibility let's say another person and I are toying with the idea of doing an event in Toronto, but I have no idea if I have any base of support in Toronto at all. So if that's something that would interest you, can you maybe just drop me a line at tomwoods.com/contact? And I won't be able to respond because I'm going to get more than I can deal with, but just rest assured that you have helped me by answering this question. So would you be able to attend or interested in attending an event that I might do in Toronto? Second thing, again, this is for Canadians, but even if you're not Canadian, you will be inspired by this. There's a new website that one of my listeners created, and it's taxliberator.ca. Now, come on, right? He says, I'm trying to help myself and my fellow Canadians find ways to reduce our tax burdens. All the information is out there, but it's written by people who don't understand how normal people are supposed to talk. I've spent a lot of time honing my ability to take overly complicated and technical stuff like tax documents and distill it down into a language your average Joe can understand. I go through the tax code looking for deductions and credits that average people can take advantage of and then communicate it in a way those average people can actually understand without having an expensive accountant or lawyer holding their hand the whole time. DIY tax avoidance, if you will. And since I'm talking about reducing people's tax burden, I'm also sprinkling in posts promoting libertarian ideas that are related. And then he goes on and gives examples of that. So there you go. So if you're interested in what you can do to minimize your so-called contributions to the Canada Revenue Agency, then check out taxliberator.ca. What a great idea for a website. And I hope you Canadian folks will support it and Americans will be inspired to emulate it. I will list this at tomwoods.com/1229 as our listener website mentioned for today. You can get publicity for your site, especially if it's an awesome one like this, if you get your web hosting through my link and get all the details at tomwoods.com/publicity, I got numerous bonuses for you that'll help you get a lot of nice traffic and have success right out of the gate. So tomwoods.com/publicity is the link for you. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.